for an in-depth analysis on the mass media world at large. It's the Fourth Estate and I'm Mick Caldwell. Well, last week might have been horrifying in terms of the coverage surrounding the natural disaster that occurred in Japan. However, this week, the country seems to have erupted into a Lord of the Flies reportage approach. Just about all corners of the quadrangle are covered in terms of this scuffle. And even our auntie was a little too hasty in posting what has been accused of a homophobic tweet on ABC's popular program, Q&A. So this week we've set our feature to global roaming, looking at some of the more concerning issues that have plagued the media without as much attention. We investigate the allegations from Google that China is blocking the country's use of its Gmail services.
After a sting video emerged showing an NPR fundraiser saying disparaging things about the Tea Party, Republican opposition to public radio heated up. And Ira Glass, host of This American Life, challenged us to tackle what had been oft-charged but rarely addressed by public radio, that it is biased.
That there was an insight from National Public Radio, or NPR, on the furore currently erupting surrounding its alleged left-wing bias and what this might result in for the public broadcaster's future. And won't someone please think of the children? At least that's what a Christian lobby group is saying about billboard advertising. So if you're looking for media coverage that delves a little deeper than the Andrew Bolt analysis of the NBN plan, do stay tuned over the next half hour for the Fourth Estate. The German newspaper Der Spiegel has published photos of American soldiers posing with dead civilians like their trophies of war. The soldiers at the heart of this scandal are accused of forming a kill squad in 2010 and of murdering innocent civilians before taking photos with the dead bodies. US officials are concerned that the release of these images will cause tensions similar to those in Iraq after photos were published showing torture at the Abu Ghraib prison in 2004. Siobhan Hunt spoke to Hasnan Kazim, the Southeast Asia correspondent for Der Spiegel, and began by asking him why it was so important to publish these photographs.
Well, Der Spiegel got these photographs, or some of these photographs, months ago already, and we found out that this is a really big story. It shows a lot about the psyche of American soldiers in war and in Afghanistan. And we had cases like this before in Abu Ghraib in Iraq. And now this is another case which shows how things go wrong in a war. And we discussed this for a long time, if it should be published or not. And I mean, it was clear that it has to be published. It is a news story. It's an issue which stirs public debate. So it was clear for us to publish them. The only question was, which photographs? Because there are such horrible pictures showing American soldiers posing with the dead bodies of people they killed. So it was for us quite difficult to find out. And we only found, to be honest, three photographs which we found okay to be published. And these three were published in Der Spiegel. All the others, there are thousands of photographs, have not been published yet.
Do you think there will be a big response in Afghanistan?
I think there will be, because this is something which we haven't seen before. I mean, as I mentioned, Abu Ghraib, that caused a lot of discussion and the public uproar, but it will be something like that, I guess, in Afghanistan. Now, the thing is that yesterday was Navroz, it's a public holiday in Afghanistan, and so people were on holiday, and there were reactions, of course, already. Especially you could see that many people in Afghanistan, those who use internet, and you could see that there was a discussion going on in the internet and Twitter and Facebook and different other social media. But I'm pretty sure that there will be a reaction today and tomorrow and the next days, and there'll be a discussion about the role of American soldiers in the U.S. again. No, sorry, in Afghanistan again.
One of the soldiers is due to face a military court on Wednesday this week. There are 12 soldiers in total that have been court-martialed. The highest ranking of those is the Staff Sergeant Calvin Gibbs. From your investigations, do you think that that is as far as it needs to go, or are there more within the American military that had responsibility here?
Well, from our investigations, we cannot say anything about that yet. I mean, the question is, what responsibility do officers, for example, have, and can they really control this? As far as we know, this group acted on their own behalf. They just went out and thought that somehow whatever they're doing there in Afghanistan is boring. They need some kind of kick, and killing could be something like that. So, it's a quite shocking attitude, but that's how it was. So, but we have to find out if there are any more people involved, and if officers, if they had done their job better, if they could have somehow tried to, stop this. But we don't know yet.
The mother of one of the soldiers involved has been filmed on American television saying that she tried to warn the military. Given that the first incident was in January and the last was in May, do you think it could have been stopped sooner?
Yes, it could have. Definitely it could have, because there was one soldier from whom we know that he informed his father about what is going on, and he was under pressure. He really felt very bad. He was one of the young soldiers who was involved in all this. But in the beginning, he was very, very unhappy. He had psychic problems, and he said he's something going miserably wrong, and they're doing things which are very wrong. But then he was scared at the other hand, because he was put under pressure, and he knew that if he would go public or if he would tell any of the superiors, he would be in big trouble, because he was part of this group. And it's exactly what happened. The other people in the group put him under pressure, and they said, well, the best thing to solve this problem is he has to participate in these killings, so then he will be part of it, and he cannot go out and say this and that happened. This young soldier, he wrote emails to his father, and he confessed what is happening. And his emails, and they show, and his whatever he says shows how things went wrong in that small group.
Southeast Asian correspondent for Der Spiegel, that was Husnain Kazim speaking there to Siobhan Hunt. The public broadcasting sector in the United States has a hazy cloud hovering after the House of Representatives voted to cut the federal funding to National Public Radio, otherwise known as NPR. The Republican-dominated House says the move is solely based on budget considerations. But many believe the cuts are due to the broadcaster's alleged left-wing bias. The bill is still to pass Congress, but with NPR's 27 million listeners across the world, there is a concern about the station's ability to serve this audience. Former senior producer at NPR, now a lecturer at the University of Technology Sydney, Neva Grant says if funding is cut, many local stations will struggle to stay afloat in this precarious economy. She spoke to John Gibb.
If federal funding were to be cut, the stations that air NPR's programming locally across the country would suffer. They would not be getting expected grants and aid and federal dollars that help pay the salaries and help them pay for the programs that are made by National Public Radio, or NPR, back in Washington. All Things Considered, Morning Edition, the flagship news programs that are generated by NPR. The member stations need federal dollars to help pay for those programs.
The Republicans wanted this bill, which is to cut NPR for federal funding, to pass in order to decrease the federal deficit. The Democrats, however, said the Republicans have long criticized NPR for having a liberal bias. How valid are these claims?
That's been sort of one of these, ever since I've worked at NPR, which has been roughly for the past 25 years, that has been an ongoing debate. And it's nothing that we would be able to resolve in this interview, unfortunately. It's a very complicated discussion, really, whether NPR has a liberal bias. The short answer is no, they don't. They cover news in a very straightforward manner. Does the ABC here in Australia have a bias? There are probably some people whose politics come to the right of the spectrum or the far right of the spectrum who would feel that the ABC does have bias. I'm sure most people who work at the ABC, as well as many listeners, don't feel they have bias. I would say that that kind of debate is similar to the kind of debate that swirls around NPR. The only issue at NPR is right now that debate is very live in the States because the Republicans have a very strong voice in the country, and that because certain things have happened at the company recently that have heightened that debate, certain events that have gotten a fair amount of news coverage.
What can you say about the argument that NPR provides some much-needed balance to the hard-right media like Fox News?
I think that's an excellent argument, and I think that one of the best tests of NPR's actual middle-of-the-roadness, if you will, in terms of its news reporting, is that often when a story airs on a controversial subject, be it abortion or gun control, which is a huge issue in the States, we get people from both sides of the spectrum complaining that we didn't do a fair job. And when both conservatives and left-wingers complain that you didn't do an adequate job covering this story, you have to believe you did something right. And every now and then you get people from both sides of the debate saying you actually did do a fair job, NPR, which is the ultimate compliment. Over the years, NPR has won countless journalism awards from the most respected institutions in the country and really the world. And, you know, you have to take sort of a net assessment of what it has accomplished and what it has provided to American audiences of all kinds, very diverse audiences across the country, before you start making sort of blanket statements about it being biased to the left.
With the U.S. House of Representatives' proposal to cut funding from NPR, what alterations do you see them making if they have to move forward without this money?
That's a really good question, and it's one that has a lot of my former colleagues shaking in their boots. As you know, I mean, the American economy is already kind of, it's very precarious right now. A lot of people have lost their jobs in many, many sectors. And so the small public radio stations scattered across the United States are already suffering for dollars. The sponsors who help sponsor the programs, the individual donors, the station members, many of them have either had to cut the amount of money that they offer to public radio or cut it back entirely just because their own financial circumstances are so strapped. So now, with the additional threat of government dollars being canceled, it raises the specter, which I think is really real for some stations, that they'll just have to shut down, that they just will not have the assets. Either that or they'll have to scramble a lot to raise money from other sources. Now, one thing that could happen that's kind of an optimistic possibility for some stations is that the whole kind of, as they say in Australia, the whole argy-bargy over this could so raise interest and empathy on the part of NPR supporters that people who haven't given in the past, people who haven't made personal donations that are made to public radio, might choose to do so because they think that public radio is so important and they don't want their local stations to go away. But that's the kind of thing you don't know is going to happen until it comes to that. Yeah. And a lot of people hope that it won't come to that.
NPR stated to have around 27 million listeners. How important is NPR and how will the audiences react to this move by the U.S. House?
I think NPR supporters and even people who are just occasional listeners of NPR, if some of those local stations really have to close their doors because they don't have adequate funding, it is going to radically change the radio landscape in the United States. It is going to mean that the kind of fair and balanced journalism that many, I can't say most because I don't know, but I will say many reasonable people believe is being supplied by NPR, that kind of journalism may disappear, maybe not for the entire country, but in the areas arguably that need it most. Rural areas, areas of smaller population that have fewer media options, or people who maybe don't have the time to kind of, you know, surf all the media options that are out there or don't have the inclination to do so. Those are the people, those are the pockets of the population that potentially stand to suffer the most.
Now, lecturing at UTS in radio journalism, that was former NPR senior producer Neva Grant, and she was speaking there to John Gibb for the Fourth Estate. Big thanks goes to the financial considerations by the Humanities and Social Sciences Department at the University of Technology Sydney and the Faculty of Arts at Macquarie University. Longer lasting sex. Winking bikini models, well, we all know them, but should these naughty bits on public billboard advertising in fact be removed? This heated debate has seen the Australian Sex Party fighting a battle with Parliament, who is calling for a G rating on all outdoor ads. This would mean a legislative system effectively censoring public spaces. The thought is that the current system doesn't meet community standards. Ellie Schneider began this report by speaking to the Sex Party's public officer, Robbie Swan.
The argument surrounds the proliferation of the sexualized images in public places, and I understand that's calling for an outdoor advertising to be G-rated. Why shouldn't all outdoor media align with the G rating that is currently used for films and computer games?
There's a difference between the printed matter guidelines, which, you know, it really, if they're going to judge billboards under a legislative framework, it would be under the Classification Act's printed matter guidelines, because billboards are big printed matter, aren't they? So if they judge them under those guidelines, then they would be liable to either an unrestricted category or a restricted one. Now, if billboards were meet the unrestricted category, I tell you what, they'd be a lot more explicit than they are at the moment, because in the unrestricted category of, you know, you've only got to look in the newsagent, you see people in picture magazines, they're unrestricted. So it's deemed that people in picture magazines, and even the, you know, the ground level version of Penthouse, say, for example, that they're okay for kids. They have a warning on them that's an M-rated warning, but it's not a legislative requirement. Those magazines are unrestricted. Now, if you could have the same level of explicitness on a billboard as you can see in people in picture and Penthouse, they'd be way more explicit than they are at the moment. The G rating, of course, is used for films. So why the Christian lobby would be demanding a G rating, like a film classification on a billboard that doesn't have a film on it, is just beyond logic, you know?
Yes, and I guess at the heart of the issue is, should Parliament be accommodating of complaints that are transparently ideological?
Well, you're right. I mean, I don't believe that's the case. I think that the, you know, the regulator, the Australian Advertising Standards Bureau, you know, our industry's had a couple of knockbacks from the Advertising Standards Bureau on billboards. We still support, you know, their ability to regulate that area pretty well. And we believe that's where the status quo should, you know, that should be.
Yes, and I mean, is the argument then that the products and services such as alcohol and weaponry, are they considered then less offensive to the general population than Sexpo, for example?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, it's a good point. I mean, you know, you go to Canberra Airport these days and there are four, you know, beautifully backlit billboards for a company called Raytheon, which are arms manufacturers.
Yeah.
And, you know, a billboard for Sexpo that shows a girl in a bikini on an Adelaide highway gets banned. And you have to think, well, you know, whose morality is being delivered here by the government? And the federal government and state governments have an order, have a standing rule that they will not allow the sex industry or any ad that even mentions sex to be put on their property.
And if the guidelines were to fall under the Australian Classification Board or the ACB, how would these guidelines and penalties be enforced? Because ultimately that comes under the responsibility of the state police forces.
Well, it would, wouldn't it? And I mean, that's exactly right. And I think it's a good point, because what you can see developing is, you know, police in patrol cars and on motorbikes on the highway having to stop and get out and check their manual to see whether this particular billboard ad for, you know, Calvin Klein underwear or something meets the proper standard. The real traffic police role is being subverted into a morality police. The governments never poll on these issues. Like morals groups, they will not use professional pollsters, even though they're happy to spend plenty of money at this. I mean, God, this whole billboard investigation by the House of Reps committee has come about through these morals, just through one or two ads. I mean, the cost of running this committee, you know, it'll be hundreds of thousands of taxpayers' dollars. There's no doubt about that. Why wouldn't they have just gone out and commissioned a poll by one of the professional pollsters, which would have cost them probably $10,000 at the most, and then they get a good idea about what people are feeling around Australia? They can ask two or three very pointed and specific questions, but they won't do it, because they're afraid that they'll get a message back from the community that's at odds with the religious lobbying that they're getting.
The Australian Christian Lobby believes a legislative framework should replace the self-regulating body, the Advertising Standards Bureau. Spokeswoman Wendy Francis believes that current outdoor advertising fail to recognise the dangerous impacts on children.
The self-regulation is not working, and certainly is not reflecting community standards. I don't think that anybody who has a financial interest in the advertising can have their own self-regulation. I think it needs to be a body that is overseeing the benefit for children or the otherwise. The problem for the self-regulation I see is that mostly it is a financial decision. There's a lot of research done on how many people complain about different billboard advertising in particular, or bus shelters, or on the side of buses. So there is hardcore evidence of people complaining about the advertising, and the highest number of advertising of complaints against different advertising, many of those ads, the complaints have been dismissed. At home, parents have a remote control, or they have some sort of a say over what their children see. They have a control over what they take the children to see. But when they walk outside the door into public space, that parent's right is actually removed.
How is the ABS out of touch with community standards, in your opinion?
Two of the highest, most complained about ads last year were dismissed by them.
And what were those ads?
One of the ads was Guess Jeans, and it was a totally topless woman. Actually, there were a number of them. I think there were about three of them on the billboard, and that was dismissed. And another one was a ad for a brothel, and it was there was a girl up there who looked like she had no clothes on, but she couldn't actually see anything, but she looked like she had no clothes on. And she was saying, tell your wife you'll be home late. So it was advertising a brothel.
So you would like to see the enforcement of a more legislative framework?
Yeah, I would like to see that children are protected by a classification system for all advertising. Our bus shelters, our buses and our billboard advertising must come into line with some sort of a classification, and we have to have some sort of control, and it can't be just self-regulation that is done by the advertisers for the advertisers.
Ending that report from Ellie Schneider was Wendy Francis, a spokesperson for the Australian Christian Lobby Group.
You're seeing live footage of a tsunami engulfing the port area.
Are you going to go out into the streets? I'm wondering what the situation is there now.
What has been your take on all the media coverage on the Japanese earthquake?
It's really devastating. Like, honestly, sometimes I have to, like, just change the channel because it's so horrible to see.
It's a pretty personal matter, actually, because my dad's girlfriend is Japanese. So she's been having not only CNN and things like that on our TV all day, every day, but we've also had like Japanese news on our running on all our laptops and everything. So
it's kind of been a bit heartbreaking.
I mean, there was a lady in her 70s, and she says she's never experienced anything as this big.
Surprisingly, like, they didn't fall into like chaos. I think Japanese people is like, they got quite strong, you know, emotion.
I can see that people face like sense of desperation, like, and a bit of frustration too.
I don't think it will ever recover.
There was an image on a handheld camera actually in the middle of the earthquake, and they were just these really small school children huddled together under a table. And
I saw a video of a cargo ship going up and down on the waves. That was quite incredible because you know, seeing something that big being tossed around in the water was, well, it stuck with me.
There was an elderly lady that was found just recently, and that definitely, probably that image, she was under there for like days and she managed to survive.
You've got to understand that this earthquake, this one in particular, has thrown up some very major issues of the breadth of coverage.
This has been one of the most challenging stories.
And in some places, there aren't enough body bags or coffins for the victims.
And how does this media coverage compare to the coverage of the other natural disasters over the last few months?
In terms of how we've covered other natural disasters, it's been excessive in comparison to them, I think.
There's a lot more facts being shown on the TV. You get a lot more individual stories on the Queensland tragedy.
We've had emails from listeners that have complained about the presenters being sent there, well, partly on the grounds that your crews are sucking up using scarce resources.
The media probably just loves it. They're just eating it up.
It sounds more like showbiz than journalism to me.
Google is claiming that the Chinese government is blocking people's access to its Gmail service. Some believe it's part of a crackdown by the Chinese regime in response to outcries for a so-called Jasmine Revolution. Some activists want to see a pro-democracy uprising, similar to those in the Middle East. Dr. Jonathan Hasid from the UTS China Research Centre says it's unclear how strong the current democracy movement in China really is. He spoke to Brit Helen Johansson.
The Chinese government has a history of trying to tamper with Google results and filtering them. And so it's really unclear whether this particular hack into Gmail is the result of the calls for the Jasmine Revolution, or whether it's just business as usual for the Chinese censorship authorities.
If the Chinese government is in fact blocking the Gmail accounts, how will this affect Chinese activists' ability to organize?
Well, potentially it makes it more difficult. Apparently what's happened is that the Chinese government has hacked into Google, into Gmail, to make it seem like people all over China have problems getting into their Gmail. And they've certainly targeted activists' email in the past. One activist several years ago got sentenced to a number of years in prison because the Chinese government was able to get into his Yahoo mail account. So, you know, I think activists in China have to be creative and figure out stuff like this. And I think probably since then, you know, a lot of them have been warier about using email for communication. So this may not have, I mean, it certainly won't help people act organize in China, but it may not have quite the chilling effect that it would have had, you know, just a few years ago.
So far, the Jasmine rallies that were called for online to take place in major cities each Sunday has not really materialized. So do you think this could be due to the tightening of internet communication?
I'm sure that the tightening of internet communication prevents a lot of people who would otherwise participate from going to these rallies. But at the same time, it's unclear to what extent the people calling for the Jasmine Revolution are really representative of the Chinese public or even, you know, elite Chinese activists more generally. You know, in general, it's very difficult to tell in China, of course, but in general, the Chinese Communist Party is actually rather popular. And so, you know, we don't know what it would look like without censorship, but I suspect that even if the Chinese government weren't trying to disrupt the calls for Jasmine Revolution, that we wouldn't have the same kind of popular activism that we're seeing in the Middle East.
Do you believe that if the Chinese government now is tightening control of the internet, do you think this could backfire for the Chinese government, making citizens more discontent with the government?
Probably not. The Chinese are well aware that the government censors the internet. I mean, the government has been censoring the Chinese media since 1949, since the communist takeover. And so I think, you know, people are not unfamiliar with the fact that the state is censoring results. And in fact, there was a survey done a couple of years ago by an organization in the U.S. called the Pew Research Foundation, and they did a survey of Chinese internet users. And the large majority, something like 80%, said that they were happy with government censorship because they didn't want to see, they didn't want their kids exposed to dangerous information and this sort of thing. So I don't think that tightening censorship further will necessarily lead too many people to get more angry.
Google has stated that this is not a fault on their side, and they're accusing the government of designing it to appear like a fault with Google. So could this be to avoid attracting international attention?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. I think, although everyone knows that the Chinese government is the world's most sophisticated internet censor, they don't like to admit it publicly. So it's certainly possible. The Chinese government also has a history of blocking foreign services right at about the same time that a domestic company has come out with competitors. So I think the Chinese government is, you know, trying to get people to stop using Gmail because they feel that they can't control Gmail as well as they could one of the domestic competitor email services.
Dr. Jonathan Hasid from the China Research Center at UTS, speaking with Britt Helen Johansson. That concludes another week here on the show that delves into the mass media communications, the Fourth Estate. Check out our website at 4thestateradio.blogspot.com for any of these stories and so much more about the show. Don't forget, you can always subscribe to our podcast, which is 4thestate.podomatic.com. So as the media continues to churn out the content, we'll be here next week. I'm Mick Caldwell.